everyone. I'm going to call the meeting of the House Committee on Rules to order for Thursday, May 4th, 2017. I'm going to walk us through the afternoon so everyone knows what's going on. So we are going to start with the work session on 2015. We'll move to a public hearing on the amendments, the dash 15s, on 2122. It'll be a public hearing only on the dash 15s. Then we'll move to 2813, and that will be a public hearing only. Then we'll move to a work session on 2342 to take testimony on the dash twos, and then finally we'll move to 2584. So plan accordingly.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to reinforce indeed that we are not working 2131 today. We continue to accomplish a lot of work and make a lot of progress on that. And so thank you for carrying it over to next week.
You're welcome. All right. With that, I will open a work session on House Bill 2015.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2015 directs Oregon Health Authority to reimburse doula at a rate of no less than $350 per pregnancy for services provided. You have a dash 6 amendment. It replaces the measure. It requires the Oregon Health Authority, in coordination with the traditional Health Workers Commission, establish reimbursement rates for doulas. Rates are to be reviewed and revised, if necessary, every even-numbered year. It identifies the factors to be considered in the rate review. Requires coordinated care organization to make information about access to doula services available to the public, requires Oregon Health Authority to study possible changes to medical assistance program to facilitate making direct payments to doulas. On September 15th of each year, Oregon Health Authority is to provide Oregon Health Policy Board, Oregon Public Health Advisory Board, and post on website report on status of doulas, specifies content of the report. You have a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue on the dash six.
Madam Speaker.
Good afternoon, colleagues. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. Madam Chair and colleagues, thank you for the opportunity today to talk about the Dash 6 Amendment to House Bill 2015, and so pleased to be here with our chief co-sponsor, Representative Hack, on this bill. This is a bill regarding doulas and the availability and accessibility of doulas in the Medicaid program. We had lots of hearings in healthcare in the healthcare committee, but we weren't quite done, so you have a Dash 6 in front of you. Just to remind you, doulas are professionals who work in a non-medical support way with women who are pregnant, both before pregnancy, during pregnancy, and after pregnancy. And we have testimony on the record from folks at OHSU about the importance of doulas in terms of outcomes for births. And according to Dr. make sure I get his name right, from OHSU, Dr. John Kennel, a pediatrician and perinatal researcher, he has said, if a doula were a drug, it would be unethical not to use it. We have great outcomes when women have access to doulas, particularly for women of color who have poorer birth outcomes in the state. We want to make sure that women on the Medicaid program have access to doulas. So what you have in front of you is the Dash 6, which primarily deals with making sure that we can build the workforce and making sure that the traditional health worker commission is working to help us build that workforce. The original bill had an actual fee that we were going to put in statute after very many years of trying to figure out how to pay doulas in a way that was appropriate for their level of care and also to incentivize a workforce. That is now being taken care of internally at OHA. We're really pleased that that has happened. And so the Dash 6 talks about working, advertise doulas to help the Traditional Health Worker Commission work on trying to recruit and grow the workforce. And we want to make sure that women who are pregnant on the health plan do know that they have access to a doula. So I'll just stop there and see if you have any questions about the Dash 6. And my testimony is online as well. And I don't know if Representative Hack.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jody Hack, State Representative for House District 19. I'm just showing my support for House Bill 2015 and the Dash 6 Amendment. I am a huge supporter of doulas and believe that this bill will accomplish many great things in the future for building a workforce. And I wish we could put a dollar amount in there, and it certainly would be more than what we started with. I think we had 350 in there in the beginning, and I was championing the cause for a whole lot more than that. So I'm going to put on the record that I hope that OHA will do right by our doulas and make sure that they're paid well for the work that they do, because it is critical to the services of women. And so I just am very supportive and hope that you'll see this through. So thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions for this panel? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Destin Black and John Eames.
Or Beth Ann Darby.
Or Beth Ann Darby.
I'm not Justin.
But hopefully I'll be a good
Justin.
Justin. I know, a different Justin.
John Kennedy Court.
Go ahead.
Sure.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm the Director of the External Relations Division at the Oregon Health Authority. I just wanted to come and thank the speaker for her leadership on this very important issue. OHA has recently completed an update to the fee-for-service rates to $350 as a global payment for doulas that includes day of delivery services and 6 pre- and postnatal visits. The updated rates are effective Monday, May 1st, so just. We're also in the process of a comprehensive communication plan that will include doulas, other providers, especially primary care and birth, CCOs, tribal partners, and members. We have the communication information that we are planning to share out widely will include information about the availability of doula services and supports, the process for becoming a certified traditional health worker and an enrolled OHP provider, information about the traditional health worker registry, and we have targeted communications that will begin mid-month to all of those parties. And happy to answer any questions, and we're very appreciative of this work.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of HealthShare, the largest CCO here in the state. And we really want to thank Speaker Kotek, Representative Hack, and all the others that have worked on this, including the agency, the Oregon Health Authority. You know, HealthShare's primary goal is to increase access and the services that doulas provide. And so this bill starts that process as far as making sure that they can get paid a good amount of reimbursement and offer their services more widely throughout not only our service area but also the state. So we just wanted to say thank you to the speaker for all of her work, and we hope to continue to push this forward and provide more services for doulas across our region.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's more of a comment. I just want to say thank you for the work that you've done in helping us move this forward. Again, I'm going to make a pitch. 6 visits, day of birth. I don't mind putting it on the record, but I had 29 hours with my first and almost that much with my second. 350 is just, in my mind, not enough. But I do appreciate the moves that you have made, and I certainly hope that this is just the beginning for doulas. But I just want to put on the record that I hope that we can do better than that, but I do appreciate the work that you have done.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, Representative Hack, just one quick, we appreciate the language in the amendment that says that OHA will study doula rates and provide a report back to the legislature that will also include information about how our current pricing structure works, and then look at revisiting the pricing structure every 2 years to just see where we are on an average with other states.
Representative Bretto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to say my first session on rules, and noticed that we had a work session before we had ever heard a bill. And so as I was going over these bills, I asked Representative Hack, since her name was on it, what is a doula today? And so she informed me, and so I called up my wife and said, you know, I don't know that this is a household term, but have you ever heard of this? And, oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah, sounds like a good bill. So anyway.
I knew I liked her.
I just want to say, you know, I don't know if we have to get accustomed to this learning in this committee, but it seems like we are throwing a lot of stuff at us that maybe we don't know a lot about. And I'm a yes on this bill, but it is a learning process. Thank you.
Note to self, call Representative Barreto.
I'm glad you called your wife, Representative Barreto. Any further comments or questions? All right. Thank you very much. We are in a work session.
Madam Chair, I move -6, amendment to the House Bill 2015.
Vice Chair McLean has moved the -6 amendment into House Bill 2015. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2015 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean has moved House Bill 2015 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. Carrier, co-carrier, Representative Kotek, co-carrier, Representative Hack. Close the work session on House Bill 2015. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2122A.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2122A requires new or existing coordinated care organization that transfers ownership to have 501c3 status, and the governing body's meetings are subject to public meetings laws. It directs the CCOs to expend all earnings that exceed financial requirements on services to address health disparities and social detriments of health as outlined in CCO's Community Health Improvement Plan. There is an emergency clause on the measure. You have a -A15 amendment. It adds public health benefit corporation after 501c3 language, specifies that CCO expends portion of the annual net income or reserves, requires Oregon Health Authority to convene and create rules of advisory committee and specifies membership, requires Oregon Health Authority to work with CCOs to develop plan to move towards greater utilization of alternative payment methodologies by December 31st, 2023, and specifies criteria of the plans. We do not yet have a fiscal or revenue on the A15 amendments.
Speaker Kotek, Representative Greenlick.
Madam Chair, thank you for this hearing. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I'm delighted to be here to talk to you and your vice chairs in the committee on House Bill 2122. In the 2011 session, we created with House Bill 3650, we invented the notion of CCOs to take over the organization and delivery of healthcare services to our Medicaid population, at that time around 650,000. The Oregon Health Authority created rules for the development, bid the contracts, and we ended up with 16 CCOs covering the whole state for the organization and delivery of services to the Oregon health plan population. The original group, which is now working, signed five-year contracts, which will be coming up at the end of next year. They now serve a little over a million people in the Oregon Health Plan and have maintained budget restraint, keeping our Oregon Health Plan budgets under 3.4% per year annual increase in medical care costs. But it's now time to look forward for the next five-year period and to talk about how to develop a sustainable model that will carry us forward in the future. It's particularly important given the uncertainty we have in what's going on in Washington and its relationship to the Affordable Care Act. This bill has come a long way from its original form. It was originally introduced as House Bill 4100 in the 2016 session, reintroduced in exactly the same form as 2122 in this session, and has evolved pretty dramatically over the time period based on our discussions with the community involved in development of the future of CCOs. The original bill had five elements. It stated that all future CCOs needed to be a community-based nonprofit organization based on 501c3 organizational forms of the Internal Revenue Service. It said that all governance meetings needed to be held according to public meeting laws. It said that all reserves beyond the reserves required to have financial status had to be invested in the social determinants of health according to this CCO's Community Health Improvement Plan. it produced some rather complex ways to measure the outcome of CCOs, and it required that CCOs develop alternative payment mechanisms and that have 80% of their output be done according to alternative payment methodologies by the year 2023, the end of the next five-year period. After series of discussions, they say, with the advocates in the area and with the CCOs themselves, we've modified four of the five elements of the original bill. At the CCO's request, we grandfathered in all existing CCOs, so as long as they carried their contracts forward, their form of organization was acceptable. We modified the new forms of any CCOs that were developed from a 501c3 nonprofit to include B Corps, a benefit corporation model that could be used to create new CCOs. We modified the requirement that all reserves beyond a minimal adequate amount be spent on social determinants health, and instead you'll find in the Dash 15 amendments a plan that will work with a rulemaking process through OHA that includes all interested parties in the process to develop how to spend that money, still spending it on the social determinants of health and improving the health of the community. We dropped out the quality measurement piece because it was too complex. And that's gone from the bill now. And we modified the alternative payment methodology. Actually, first we dropped it out of the bill because there was objections to it. But in the Dash 15s, it's back in with a plan to move towards alternative payment methodologies, but to do it at a contracted and more gradual way, working out a process. Now, I say all of those were at the request of the CCOs themselves. The only one that remains the same is the fact that all governance in the new contract, all governance meetings need to be held under the public meeting laws. You also have in your packet a report from the Oregon Health Policy Board, which we asked to take a look at CCOs and to make recommendations both for the legislature and for OHA themselves. And two of the four recommendations you'll find in there specifically are addressed in the Dash 15 in 2122 as amended by the Dash 15. The public meeting transparency, they heard over and over how important transparency was in the governance of the CCOs. They are spending $10 billion a year of taxpayer money, $10 billion. The Oregon Health Policy Board felt it was very important that that be spent in public so that we can monitor how those expenditures are made. And the second piece they made was the social determinants of health, arguing that any extra money from the CCO should be spent on the social determinants of health. We've come a long way on this bill. I hope you'll take it seriously, and we'll move it to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the Dash 15s of House Bill 2122A, and I appreciate Representative Barreto's comments. You get a lot of new things, so I'm going to take the time to actually go through my testimony because of the importance of the bill. You know, when we started transformation of the health plan back in 2011, our goals were to get better value for the money we invested in care, move away from fee-for-service model toward value-based payments, provide the flexibility to innovate and address community needs, and do all of this while keeping below a cost curve of 3.4%. Coordinated care organizations have been able to serve Oregon's Medicaid expansion population successfully. Since 2013, approximately 400,000 new people have enrolled. We have also seen initial success through creative investments in the communities, a 60% increase in patient-centered primary care homes enrolled since 2011, and a corresponding decrease in hospital admission for chronic diseases by 60%. That is good progress. Still, we have more work to do, and this really isn't about what's wrong with the system, but planning for the future. When we began this journey, we knew we would need to keep innovating and moving forward. House Bill 2122A with the Dash 15 amendment keeps challenging us as a state and moves us in the right direction by formalizing some of the lessons we have learned over the past 5 years. I'm supporting this bill and have been working closely with Representative Greenlake to make sure that the legislature takes action to ensure that CCOs meet our vision of success 5, 10, and 15 years from now. So I want to specifically talk about the Dash 15s. As you note, they're dated today. We have been listening and amending, and we happen to get a few more thrown in here, so we apologize for the late notice, but there's been a lot of work, so the Dash 15s are encompassing all the comments we have received up until this point. Reserves. This was a particularly challenging way of, you know, we want to get to people and more work on social determinants of health, but people weren't sure how it was written in the last couple drafts. We feel like the Dash 15 gets it right. CCOs, as you know, are made possible by Oregonians' tax dollars and federal tax dollars as well as state. They deliver taxpayer-funded care to approximately 25% of Oregonians, and it is our responsibility to protect those funds and the people they serve. As it stands, taxpayer money intended to pay for health care for Oregonians has and could possibly end up enriching executives and shareholders. We must address the issue of whether and how CCOs manage the reserves to protect the public's investment. The Dash 15 addresses this by requiring CCOs to invest a portion of annual net income into the community. The portion does not come out of required reserves, administrative dollars, or money set aside for direct medical care. We are requiring a portion of excess dollars be invested directly into the community. The Dash 15 accomplishes this through rule where stakeholders, and it is our expectation that stakeholders include Medicaid beneficiaries, community-based organizations, among others, contributing to the design of this investment. So we wanted that's been clarified in the Dash 15s. Furthermore, beginning in 2019, we will require all new stewards of the state health plan be a community-based nonprofit or a public benefit corporation. We added B Corps as, quote, they are restricted so that on dissolution, the corporation must distribute the corporation's assets to an organization organized for a public or charitable purpose, a state, or a person that is recognized as exempt under Section 501c3, unquote. We believe this further contains the risk that state dollars intended for the delivery of health care to Oregonians could be funneled out of state through sale or merger. It also holds CCOs accountable to their communities. That's a very important part of the Dash 15. It's also about transparency. As mentioned, CCOs should be held accountable to the state and the members they serve. I support CCO transparency measures because an enrollee should know what and how decisions are being made about their care. Providers should also have access to this process. This bill institutionalizes basic tenets of CCO operations, and I believe we should build off these basic principles as we move further into the future of healthcare transformation. The Dash 15 accomplishes this by requiring all governing board meetings be subject to public meeting laws. It is our expectation that in the case of a CCO that has a contractual relationship with an external governing body, the requirement for adhering to public meeting law is applicable to the external governing body and not to the entity that holds the CCO contract, if they differ. There are 14 exemptions afforded to CCOs through current statute, exemptions that allow for executive session when sensitive material is being discussed. We have posted this on OLIS for your reference. Lastly, innovation. You're going to hear from folks that this is going to stifle innovation in CCOs. When we began the process, the implementing legislation encouraged alternative payment methodologies under a global budget to drive cost savings and quality by changing why and how we pay for care. The Dash 15 requires OHA to support CCOs in further institutionalizing alternative payment methodologies by setting a benchmark collaboratively and setting a plan for each CCO to reach that benchmark. We do not prescribe a set percentage in statute, and that was per feedback from the CCOs on a previous draft. So, colleagues, we have listened, we have amended. I hosted two meetings in my office, you know, myself, with Representative Greenlake to hear. The comments have been a little slow in coming, but we feel like we are trying to incorporate them all in the Dash 15. We believe the Dash 15 aligns with our Medicaid waiver. It aligns with the basic principles of the Oregon Health Policy Board recommendations. And it really is about the future. It's not about bad actors now or something the CCOs are doing now. We might not have the same people who were there at the beginning. We have founding parents, so to speak, in these CCOs. If that leadership moves on, and some has, and if CCOs get sold, as some have, things will change if we do not take care to put some safeguards to prevent that. And that's what this is about. We urge you to support the Dash 15s today, add them into the bill when you're ready to do so, and move the bill to the floor if you're able. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative McLean.
Yes, Madam Speaker, I understand that there are for-profit CCOs and nonprofit CCOs. Do the nonprofit CCOs deliver better care?
Madam Chair and Representative McLean, I don't think this is about better care. This is about future governance of new CCOs and ensuring the accountability of the millions and millions of dollars that come through to them to provide care for the Oregon Health Plan. As we have amended the bill, current CCOs, regardless of their governance structure, will continue to be CCOs provided they, you know, submit and apply and get a new contract in the next five-year cycle. We believe that ultimately ensures quality because we are ensuring accountability. Whether or not a nonprofit or for-profit does it different, that is not the issue.
If your answer is that you can distinguish no difference in care provided our Medicaid citizens between a nonprofit CCO and a for-profit CCO, and you have referenced a sale, is it fair to characterize the crux of this bill as not wanting to see a contract provider, CCO, have people profit by the sale of assets used in the delivery of medical care?
Madam Chair and Representative McLean, I would say no. Again, this is about governance. This is about accountability moving forward. And we heard loud and clear that it would be a challenge for people to change their governance structure now, but if someone wants to be, run a CCO in the future, we're hoping that they will be a B Corp or a nonprofit. That's the point of the bill.
Then my follow-up is, then why do you care if, say, a group of physicians who put together a for-profit CCO and deliver that, hitting the benchmarks on quality of care, and through innovation are able to have assets and employees and a whole delivery system that has value, why do you care if they profit by the sale?
Madam Chair and Representative McLean, I care about the accountability. I care that this is unique to, I think, contracts with the state on the scale of the dollars. During the creation of CCO transformation, under the leadership of then Governor Kitzhaber, and many of us, I believe Representative Kenemer was one of those folks, along with Mitch and I, many, many hours deciding how we would transform the health plan. There was conversation about how you would give the tight, loose conversation. Remember that one? We're going to, you know, hold you accountable, but give you lots of flexibility. We're still holding people accountable, and we're still giving a lot of flexibility. This is about making sure that the motivations for new CCO leadership in the future is really focused on what is going to happen here in the state, and we think the best way to do that is through nonprofit and B corporations in future governance.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could comment on that as well.
Yes.
I think the issue isn't so much the development of the care models, which have been varied in one place or the next. The issue is what happens to the money that's produced on behalf of a community. And it's our belief that the tax dollars we put into a CCO, we put it in on behalf of the community that served, not on the behalf of shareholders. We've seen it one time already where $130 million of profits that came out of taxpayer money went back to a few stockholders in the corporation rather than being dedicated to the development of the best health of the community. So the issue is really, we think, the ability of whether a manager's decision is made on behalf of stockholders as a manager of a profit-making organization is required by law to be first interested in their stockholders, or whether it's a community-based organization that's first interest in the use of assets to help that community.
Can I follow up then? So based on the speaker's answer that the motivation of a for-profit entity, the leaders, would be questioned in your statement, Representative Greenlich. It appears to me confusing, because if the state contracts with somebody to deliver a service for a price, and they deliver that service for a price, you're viewing how they use their profits for that delivery. They are the ones who took the risk. They're the ones who put in the capital and built the infrastructure. And if they delivered the health care that is no different than a nonprofit, why do you resent the fact that they made profit?
I don't resent anything. I just believe that we need to be good stewards of tax dollars. The CCOs are not a manufacturing organization that showed up de novo in a community. They're the inventions of the legislature. We put them together to create a model that would use our money to take care of the needs of the population. Our interest is to assure that that happens in the future. Mostly that is occurring now, but the issue we want as we're going forward in the sustainable model is to make sure these essentially quasi-public organizations, because we put them together to serve that function, continue to serve the best interests of the community.
Well, Madam Chair, I've got a lot of questions, and I don't want to take more time, but I must say that if I have one last follow-up. Representative Greenlich, you view, in essence, CCOs, you said, as quasi-public. So then the folks who actually put in their capital and took the financial risk, because when I voted for that bill, you and others represented to me in 2011 that the CCOs would be at risk. And you're now saying that those people who put their capital at risk are quasi-public, and therefore we can come in after the fact and say your private benefit of your risk has created public resentment. And that's something I just don't understand.
I never said anything about public resentment. I said our job is to monitor. I'm sure it's your interest, too. Our job is to monitor the way state dollars and federal dollars are spent. We have a responsibility to assure going forward in the future that we set things up in a way that create a stable environment and make sure that the best interests of the state and the communities are served. We believe, as a matter of fact, that the best way to do that is to make sure going forward we have community-based organizations that are serving the public needs.
But what we've just heard from the speaker, there has been no distinction between the delivery of care, the quality of care, between a CCO that is for-profit and a CCO that is not for-profit.
Well, in fact, nobody's asked that question.
Well, I just did, and the speaker answered.
No, I say nobody's asked the question. I looked at the data to find out if there is a difference.
I bet you we could find that out pretty quick.
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, if I can. You know, I think some of this has to go back to 2011. If you recall, we were in co-governance. I think there were a lot of decisions made to try to find the best middle path. And if you recall at the time, we were asking the Medicaid managed care plans, some were for-profit, some were non-profit, to get involved in this endeavor called CCOs. They did choose to do that. I would argue at the time it was financially a good idea for them to do that. They were doing okay, even though for us, costs were going up. We were trying to control costs. So I think at the time we wanted to honor the fact that folks had been doing the business to become that first wave of CCOs. We're now into the second contracting cycle. Next year we will put an RFP out for new contracts that will start in 2019. When the original bill came out, we heard loud and clear that it would seem unfair to say, hey, for that next contract, if you're a for-profit now, we want you to change your governance structure. That seemed to go against the kind of agreement made at the beginning. My question to you and to anyone who wants to answer it when they testify is, I hear this question of like, well, are you making a statement about for-profits or nonprofits? Not necessarily. We're making a statement about going forward, if some CCO decides I want to get out of the business, that new CCO will be either a nonprofit or a B Corp for the purposes of having the accountability and the trust that the best interests of Oregonians are at heart. And what I haven't heard from people of why the current people who are grandfathered in have such a fear about this statement. What is about this that is a problem for them? I'd like to really understand that. It does not affect them. They want to keep this contract the next 5, 10, 15 years. They can stay a for-profit. If a new one wants to come in or they want to transfer it, I would like you to ask them, what is the issue? I would really like to hear it on the record.
I would love to continue, but I know there's other people. I'd love to answer that question, and I think the speaker has opened the door up to what is a clash of philosophies, but ultimately we ask people to perform a service. They're performing the service, and but I don't want to.
Is there a threat of a lawsuit that you're worried about?
No.
Is that what you just said? I'm sorry.
He said philosophies.
Philosophies.
Not lawsuits.
Oh, I thought you said glass menagerie. Yeah. Okay. What's your
the
reference?
Old leader.
Not against lawsuits. I'm a lawyer. Right?
Representative Kammerer.
No, I'm just teasing. But,
we are in a realm of dueling philosophies often in this building.
Okay. Representative
that
Kammerer.
That makes more sense.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess maybe a comment, being involved in those 2011 discussions. You know, we had an interesting discussion about nonprofits and profits and variations thereof. And I think, as I recall, the upshot of that was that we needed some time to evaluate, and we would evaluate in due course who was doing the best job and whether competition provided better service or how it went. And I guess my comment is it seems that at this point we don't have the data and it's a little premature to decide.
I think that's the reason we grandfathered in all the existing CCOs.
Yes, excuse me, another. I understand that. I think, unfortunately, it doesn't honor the original agreement, which was to decide which was better. It makes a preference for the future.
Madam Chair and Representative Kennemer, I don't think there was ever any commitment to test the governance structure, but, you know, if we had... If that is somewhere people want to go down, we could do that. I don't believe the point.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, again, I'm a little new to this too, but if the for-profit CCOs are making pretty good profits and the nonprofits are providing the same type of service, what do they do with all of their surplus dollars that that they have?
They're required to spend the surplus dollars above whatever is defined as a minimum to save fiscally responsible. On behalf of a community improvement plan that they worked out with their community and their community advisory committee, and the funds are supposed to go into the community on behalf of that plan.
So how are new CCOs, we only have 16 of these, I understand, in the state. So, and obviously if they're working quite well with Medicaid, then I would think that we could use more of them. And so how are new CCOs funded? I would think that if they were privately held, that they would use their profits to start up more CCOs, and they would be engines of opportunity. And so how would private or public held CCOs continue to expand?
They've been formed in the past by having sponsoring organizations that help provide assets to get started under the assumption that those assets will be held responsibly. We have, I think, about almost half of them now are community-based, and about half are for profit. I think that's not exactly right, but something close to that balance.
Just one more follow-up. So you mentioned profits. So the nonprofits are making profits, and you're saying a portion of that 50% would be used for future CCOs, and then the other 50% of what they retain would be used in the community?
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, they are successful social organizations, and therefore, by managing carefully, they have more income than they have expenditures. It's that surplus of income to expenditures that they use rather than on delivering personal health care services, delivering services into the community.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Representative Barreto, I think one of the things that's worth saying is there was no growth strategy conversation when CCOs were formed. The 16 CCOs, to a large degree, were a lot of the folks who were delivering Medicaid managed care prior to transformation. There were some new ones formed. But a lot of the same players, you even have some players in some communities and several CCO boards. So there's a lot of cross-germination. I'm going to just go out on a limb and say I think there's some concern out there that this bill is part of a effort to somehow reduce the number of CCOs or change coverage geographies. That could be I want to be say this on the record right now. I'm fine with the 16 CCOs we have. They could all continue to do this work for the next 15 years for all I care. This is if something changes, we're protecting our taxpayer dollars for the future. And there is some surplus. And once you've taken care of all those little pots of monies you've committed, reserves, some long-term commitments you've made, if you've decided to build housing in your community as a CCO, we want to make sure you have that money set aside. But having that additional surplus, whether it's profit, I mean, whatever, the nonprofits, they put in their foundations and then do whatever, this would allow that surplus to go based on a community plan back for social determinants. We want to be clear about that, that reinvestment in the community to improve overall community health was part of the vision of CCOs when they started.
All right, Representative. Thank you, Chair. So I just wanted to clarify one thing if I could. So on the nonprofit side, and they're making profit, as a nonprofit, they don't pay tax. The for-profit folks are paying taxes and therefore benefiting our state on the revenue side. Are you at all concerned about the fact that I understand the benefit because you're saying that they are supposed to give back to the communities, but then they're giving back to just the community where they're at, where the for-profits give back in tax that they pay for revenues for the entire state. So can you just I'm trying to kind of wrap my head around that piece of it.
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, I don't think we're not privy to what taxes they do pay. If you're a for-profit, if you have an office space, I suppose you would pay property tax. They're all paying, you know, the payroll taxes and whatnot for their employees. You know, knowing who's paying what, it's really hard to answer that question. I
just want to make sure we can get to the other panels.
Right.
I just have
one follow-up. Yep. I think what I'm trying to get at is if part of the issue that we're raising today is that they're making so much money and that we have an onslaught of, you know, the for-profits and the accountability piece and we're in a revenue crunch by converting future nonprofits or future CCOs into nonprofits, there's a revenue potential there because they're making money and they're paying taxes. And for-profit business is how we generate revenue. So we want to make sure that we increase for-profit businesses. So I'm just curious if you're at all concerned about the fact that we would not it's stopping the production of tax base revenue, given the fact that these are, I don't know if I'm getting that out exactly the way that I want to, but I get that they're giving back, but they're only giving back to that community where a for-profit CCO actually gives back to the entire state by paying taxes on the profits that they make.
Right. Madam Chair and Representative Hack, again, I think it's a little hard, but I do think one thing is worth clarifying here. And I made some comment earlier about how you're structured. There are a lot of for-profit and nonprofit providers who make up the governance boards of CCOs, from hospitals, for-profit, nonprofits, mostly nonprofits. You have physician associations. You have, you know, variety of entities, community-based and not, that make up the governance of a CCO. We're talking about the CCO itself, HealthShare versus Providence, Legacy, pick the people who are in HealthShare. It really does depend on the CCO and how they're structured. I don't think the CCOs themselves pay a lot of taxes per se. But I don't know that for sure, and I think it really depends on how they're all structured. So
I would also like to say, Madam Chair, if I can,
we've got a bunch
of things
that we're not talking about making excess profits. I just wanted to make sure that that's not what the issue is. The issue is the reserves mount up, and the question is what happens to those reserves. Okay.
Excuse me, could you repeat that last sentence? I didn't hear it.
I said we're not suggesting that there was excess profits made by the CCOs. I've never suggested that. It's just that over time the reserves build up, and the question is what happens to those reserves?
Right. All right.
I'd say to represent Greenlake, I think that's exactly what we hear you saying. So if you are actually trying to say that in moving this bill, you're not saying there are excess profits in CCOs, I got to tell you, that's exactly what I'm hearing you say.
No, you're hearing me correctly then. What I'm saying is the profits are pretty much regulated by the rate-setting process. What's happened over time on an ongoing basis is reserves build up, both in the nonprofit and in the profit organization. They both have reserves. There are about $923 million in reserves right now held by the 16 CCOs, only almost $1 billion. The issue is what happens to those reserves. Are they spent on behalf of the community, or are they spent on behalf of a select group of taxpayers, I mean of owners inside the organization?
All right.
Okay,
with
so
that,
he is saying there's excess profits. Then you are saying there's excess profits.
No, I'm not saying there's excess profits. I think the profits have been proper, both in the revenue over expenditures, I think, has been appropriate in both forms of CCOs, and I've never said otherwise. The reserves have been built up over time, and the issue is what happens to those reserves.
And Madam Chair and Representative McClain, the purpose of the Dash 15 is to clarify the reserves and how those other pots of money that are left over when you pay claims, and if they've not pre-allocated for other reasons that serve the community, that pot of money will go back into the community. Otherwise, it provides a real incentive for someone to come, buy out a CCO, and take that money to wherever. So.
All right, we're going to move on because we're not moving the bill today. We can have continued conversations. We have a bunch of people signed up, and we have more bills to come. So, Paul Phillips, Josh Ballack, Courtney Johnston, all here. Okay, I don't think Paul's here.
Sure, I want to spend the night here.
Careful.
I don't think Paul's here.
Okay, then Jennifer Johnston too, as well. We can get folks up here. Like I said, we're going to hear this again. We're not moving it, so please bear that in mind. We've got a bunch more bills.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, for the record, Courtney Johnston. I'm here today on behalf of Coalition for Healthy Oregon. We are a coalition of 8 of the 16 CCOs and affiliated providers who serve about half of the Medicaid population. And I just appreciate that we're having a hearing on this bill today. And I'm going to briefly set the stage and then turn it over to these folks. So I think you heard a little bit of the history of how CCOs were created. I think COHO was instrumental in the establishment of the CCO system. We worked with Governor Kitzhaber and the hospitals and long-term care and dental groups and labor representatives and DHS. And we came to a consensus draft. And leadership and the legislative leadership adopted overwhelmingly by both bodies. But more importantly, I'm here to talk about how it's a tremendous success, and Oregon is considered a national model that other states are looking to replicate. Now, to be sure, we do have our detractors, of a few that weren't in those meetings, but we've been tremendously successful. As relates to House Bill 2122, I think it's worth noting that the original draft specifically decided to include both profit and nonprofit groups within the CCO process, which resulted in better innovation through unique partnerships. The structure was meant to be flexible so that each region could create local solutions, but all of those CCOs are statutorily required to be community-based. The structures allowed those groups to serve the Oregon health plans in the best way that for their communities. And the idea that more money is invested in the community by nonprofits is, I just want to say, not borne out by the facts. We have reviewed the publicly available data than last year that shows that not nonprofit CCOs actually retain less earnings, therefore spending more money in their communities than the nonprofits have. I would invite you all to read that. It's all publicly available, audited financial data, for more information there. I do want to address the reserves issue. The number that I keep hearing repeated is not really an accurate accounting of reserves. It's a lot more is included in that number. That's all assets. That's everything that's beyond the spent out in the administrative budget. Everyone recognizes that reserves are intended to cover long-term liabilities. So whether nonprofit or not nonprofit, our current restricted reserve requirement needs to actually be increased. This was always assumed during the creation of the CCOs and has been reported by both the House and the Senate Healthcare Committees as recently as 2 months ago by the Oregon Health Authority. With this understanding, the CCOs have taken it on themselves to build up their reserves for their future needs, and this measure as proposed, we think, really derails this prudent planning process, which isn't good for the state, their CCO, or the members we serve. So in 2011 and ever since, people have suggested the public meetings laws be subject to the CCOs. The system, though you created, does mandate accountability by specifying who sits on our boards: physicians, nurses, behavioral health providers, community members. The legislature also required an important community accountability mechanism baked into the model through the creation of Community Advisory Council, which you're going to hear a little bit more about. But they represent the needs of their diverse communities. These are made up of community-based organizations, local governments, and majority consumers, and has successfully connected CCOs with community partners to address social determinants of health and break down silos in health delivery. This mechanism is already happening. These councils drive the board's investments, but I'll let them speak to that. I do want to put this piece in perspective. Under current law, a private body does not become subject to the public meetings law merely because it receives public funds, contracts with governmental bodies, or performs public services. The change in this bill represents a massive precedent, and I really want you to consider the full consequences of requiring this on your private contractors. A lot of people looking at this and saying, what's next? Should all of our subcapitated entities then have to be subject to public meeting laws and these cumbersome requirements? Should every hospital and every doctor's clinic or every caterer or paper distributor have to be subject to this? I just asked the question. But the thing I do want to get on the record is we do have concerns about this process. The original iteration of 2122 was introduced as a conversation starter in 2016. A myriad of concerns were expressed. The proponents, to credit, he decided to hear from the people who are affected most by CCOs. So they asked the 9-member independent policy board to conduct a 6-part listening session across the state to gather feedback from healthcare stakeholders, community members, and Oregon Health Plan members regarding their concerns for the future of the CCO model. We do not feel like that feedback is represented in this bill. I encourage you to read the letter and the recommendations from the Oregon Health Policy Board. Their recommendations are, however, reflected in a letter signed by all 16 CCOs agreeing to an alternative proposal that's based on their recommendations and aiming to maintain compliance with our federal waiver, which we think is really important. And those would have increased requirements for paying for quality, brought greater transparency, and required sustainable investments for community-based projects. That is, I think, what the CCOs were trying to push for throughout this process. But the bill before you does represent a gut and stuff with new amendments, and we're very happy to finally be here to talk about them today. Lastly, I think you'll hear today from this bill doesn't come without a significant cost. While a previous iteration of this bill did have a fiscal, the Ways and Means referral and the fiscal were rescinded, and we do think that the Budget Committee should review it. And in closing, I just want to say the House voted today on the ACA changes, which creates an immense amount of uncertainty for CCOs. And we are full risk entities, and we're under, at this time, the financial and regulatory uncertainty that would come from that changes federally and the passage of this bill, we think add too much uncertainty to what we're doing today. So thank you.
Hi. Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Johnston. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm the health strategy officer for Primary Health. We are a small, locally owned CCO in Josephine County. We have about 10,000 members, and we are for-profit. So I can explain from the perspective of a for-profit CCO the concerns that I see with this bill. And I guess I agree at a high level that the philosophy comes from a good place, but I have concern, and I guess I also would like to say that I appreciate the compromises that have been made to try to make this a more palatable piece of legislation. However, I feel mostly that it's entirely unnecessary. The Oregon Health Plan has a long history of processes and policies that are based in fact and evidence. And I feel like this bill is based out of speculation, conjecture, and potentially fear of what might happen. I think the unintended consequence of this bill is that we start to remove some of the flexibility and local control from the CCOs. And I think before moving forward with something like this, there would need to be research that would show what are the differences in quality and outcomes between CCOs with different types of governance structures? What are the differences in the level of community investments? And are there differences in how people are stewards of their dollars? Because I find it somewhat offensive, the implication that a for-profit organization would be a less careful steward of public dollars, because that is not what I see at our CCO. So I'll talk a little bit about value-based payment. That's a part of this. I think you're preaching to the choir with CCOs. We have created a lot of different pilots for alternate payment methodologies. The Oregon Health Authority measured that recently and documented 73 separate different APMs, alternate payment methodologies, within the 16 CCOs, so an average of 5 apiece. And all of those are like tests, trials, they're pilots. We're figuring out what works, what level is necessary, and what is most effective at moving the needle for cost and quality. So in my work at the CCO as the health strategy officer, I am responsible for our transformation plan. I am responsible for our outcomes on the quality pool measures. I am responsible for making sure that we are meeting the needs of our community and transforming the care in the way that we said we would. And I am passionate about that. And I believe that we have a wonderful story at our CCO. And I can tell you that people aren't coming to ask us about that story before developing this type of legislation. I think that the story is much greater than what's being captured, and we're making much greater improvements, and those improvements are accelerating, and they are notable. And the interesting thing is my phone rings a lot more often from people outside of the state of Oregon than inside of the state of Oregon, and I think that that is unfortunate. So we'll talk a little bit about primary health community investment. So we're a 10,000-member CCO. This year, we had a 6.5% rate cut, which was the deepest rate cut I am aware of any of the CCOs. And even with that rate cut, we increased the level of spending in our community for social determinants and community-level transformation. And so this year, combined with last year, we are well over $1 million, and that does not include any of the payments that we have made towards primary care incentives for quality. So we're spending that money on schools, we're working with mental health, with community partners. But the other thing that this bill doesn't mention is that it's not just about giving away money. It's about using the CCO as a vehicle to engage the community and make meaningful change towards the social determinants of health. And that is far greater than just setting a rate that needs to be spent in the community. So I guess what I would close is I think the CCOs are a sustainable model. I think we need to be careful to preserve the flexibility because we are learning, and we are learning at a rapid pace. And I think that we can be measured with accountability through the Oregon Health Authority through the process that is laid out in our contracts and in the waiver with the CMS. Part of the team that leads our external reviews, and I can tell you there is a great deal of accountability for the CCOs in meeting all of those elements that are laid out in the waiver and in rule and in contract. So, Josh, sorry.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Josh Ballack. I'm here on behalf of All Care Health CCO. We serve Jackson, Josephine, Curry, and the extreme southern Douglas County. I don't know if everybody has such a great resource as Representative Barreto's wife, so I've actually prepared a video to kind of talk a little bit about and to demonstrate a case of exactly what we're doing. Is pull it in play?
We need to keep moving, Josh. Sorry.
Well, I kind of based all of my, it's 3 minutes. It's worth it. I promise.
End up staying late. This keeps happening. He was 12 minutes.
I understand.
Cancer through my female doctor, and she's the one that spotted something wrong in my mouth. She referred me in the beginning, and so I went to a specialist in Grant Pass, and he did the biopsy, and that's when I had the bad cancer, a tumor, and they had to remove half of my palate. Gum lines, sinuses, all in the side. They had to go through the neck. They took from my arms to replace what they took out. So I had to wait a while before I could get teeth. And they did not think anyone would be able to fit me with teeth so I could smile and so I could eat.
So I met Donna through the care coordinator, Kathy Mahana, and she had emailed me expressing some concerns about Donna's care or lack thereof because it was difficult to find someone that could make her a denture. I called the DCO and asked if we could get her seen in an office in Eugene because we couldn't get the denture made here. At the time, Donna's new dentures were not covered by the Oregon Health Plan, but after talking with Capital Dental Care, they agreed to pay for them. And after that, I contacted the care coordinators to see if we could get transportation arranged for her because it was going to be too difficult for her to drive up there herself. So we worked with the care coordinators and the intensive case managers, and we got her transportation arranged for her to get up to Eugene. We got her up there in one day, got the denture fitted in the morning, the impressions taken, the denture seated in the afternoon, and it's rarely done in one day, but because of her her transportation issues and challenges, we were able to get it done. She has had a remarkable success with them, not only gaining weight, but also being active and out in the community and lifting her head up high and being able to smile again.
They made me look normal again. And I feel good about myself now. I love people. I'm loving life now. I can actually, I feel better about myself. And I'm very, very happy and blessed.
So Donna was down to 80 pounds at one point, and talking with our care coordination team, they flat out said that she would have likely died pre-CCO because there wasn't the coordination to be able to make this happen. And, you know, it's a great success story, and I'm very proud to work for a company that actually does this every day to be able to help people. But Donna and maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of other women just like her are living healthier, fuller and longer lives because of the CCOs, the system that we've set up under the leadership of Representative Greenlick, Speaker Kotek, Representative Tim Freeman, Senator Alan Bates, and so many other bipartisan leaders that really stepped up to really make this system truly transform and really coordinate that care. But the reason that I brought the story was particularly to talk about and to illustrate where there are an awful lot of things that we are doing already that this bill is trying to address that are actually in that story. So if you look, there's a lot of talk about APMs inside and trying to create mandates and these types of things. Interestingly, we had an APM with all of our dental care providers pre even the expansion population. And we were doing shared savings. So if we were able to share save money by hitting metrics, we would share that with our DCO providers. It was already built into the contract. So Capital Dental just was not only incentivized financially or morally and ethically and just trying to do the right thing, but there was financial incentive for them to get engaged, to be able to address these issues that were facing Donna. So they ended up paying and helping her be able to hit that because it was financially the right thing to do. Then you start to talk about investing in the community. Capital Dental then came back to us that next year because we had ended up hitting all of our metrics and delivering good quality care. And we gave them a check for shared savings. They asked if they could take that money and then reinvest it back into the community to basically pay for screenings for every middle schooler in Jackson and Josephine County, regardless of payer, to be able to do dental screenings and sealants for all the kids, which was amazing. We said, great, absolutely, let's do that. It's going to help with our metrics. It's the right thing to do. Let's have that happen. So what we saw was one of the things was kids weren't getting the permission slips in, so we couldn't do the screenings. We held the screenings. Kids wouldn't get in there. So All Care ended up saying, well, we'll just pay for a public ad and put it out there and incentivize people to fill out the permission slip so that we could get the kids in to get the screening if we got the services. And it ended up working. We ended up hitting our metrics, and guess what? Now we hit another metric. Now we're able to get money. It's the system that got set up. It's a great system where we're actually incentivized to try to do these things where we're using the APMs. And we have APMs with every provider, specialist, dental, mental, primary care, hospitals, even nursing homes. Trying to incentivize these types of things, but they were born organically inside of the community, and that is one of the main key parts of this and why we get worried immensely when we start seeing state things coming down in a system that's already set up to work. Well, I'm not even going to get into a lot of other stuff. I do appreciate it. I think one of the big problems that we've got with this particular bill is it feels like they're coming in and creating a box to go check. And it's okay, you got to check the social determinants of health box. The problem is when you start creating boxes, people start writing checks to just check the box as opposed to actually coming up with innovative ideas, creative solutions to get out of that process. These CCOs are set up to actually make to be able to be creative. And we are financially, as a system, our founders, our godparents all kind of put together a system globally to make this happen. Because you got to remember, we live at 3.4. Standard rate of growth is out here at about 5 to 7.5%. That delta is getting bigger every year. And we have two options. We either make the health of the community better so that we don't have to spend as much on healthcare, or we go bankrupt. It's that simple. As simple as it is elegant. So we really fundamentally think that what we're doing is delivering care. You've seen our metrics really set the stage. We are a national model. I have been amazed at the amount of other states that have been calling us, and I would agree. I would like even more states to be able to call up and really get involved. But and we're not done pushing the envelope. I mean, All Care said, hey, you know, we act like a benefit corporation. We go around. We actually invest in all these monies, but we have a board of governors, or we had a board of directors, and we said, hey, let's become a benefit corporation, because for two main reasons. One, it would prevent us from having maybe a shareholder say, well, you're not doing your fiduciary responsibility if you're investing long term. So that would protect our board members from that. But also, it would tell future boards, hey, this is the way you need to be. You know, this is who we are. We're about investing in the community. And when we took it even a step further past that, where we're getting B-Lab certified, which is an independent review to say you're actually doing the investments that you say you're doing. You're improving the health of the community. And I'm proud to say that we just submitted our certification. We haven't gotten it done yet. But you need 75 points to get certified, and we're at like 120, give or take. So we think that we'll get there. So, you know, I think with everything that's been going on at the federal level, there is an immense amount of stress. I think that it's been mentioned that we are at full risk. That is incredibly important to understand as we are out there making these types of decisions. We want to be here for the long run. We are setting up ourselves to be able to be here so that we can go through these ebbs and flows that go in the insurance market. And everything shows that the insurance market is going to start going down. It's just it's in these waves. And we are those reserves, I know there's a little concern about maybe too much, but that is why we have them there, to be able to deal with the bad times, which we're pretty sure are coming. I really appreciate you, Madam Chair. Thank you so very much.
So I'm going to close this public hearing now, and if we have time at the end of the committee, we'll continue this. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on 2122A. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2813.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2813, as currently drafted, directs Oregon Department of Justice to study prosecutions of unlawful dissemination of intimate images. It requires report to legislature. You will be discussing a potential amendment to the bill. It does replace the measure regarding internet privacy.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Jennifer Williamson, State Representative for House District 36, which is Northwest and Southwest Portland. In recent months, we've seen momentum towards the erosion of internet privacy at the hands of Congress, the President, and the Federal Communications Commission, and I can tell you that Oregonians have noticed. I've received calls and emails and letters from my constituents concerned about this issue in particular. In March, Congress voted to repeal the Obama-era internet privacy rules, which could allow internet service providers to sell their customers' information. This includes everything from browsing habits to app usage to geolocation data. Since I was elected in the Oregon House in 2013, I have worked hard on a bipartisan solutions to protect privacy. I believe there's a sweet spot between modernizing our world and protecting our privacy, and it's our job to ensure that people know what information is available and what ways to make their own information secure. And I think we're at a critical moment in the history of privacy rights in America. We can accept that our private information, shared with the very companies we pay to provide us service, is no longer private and can be collected without our knowledge, or we can decide that's unacceptable. So today, available on OLIS under meeting materials, there is what will be the dash to amendments. LC is still working on them, but the outline of the amendment is there. So we'll soon have the official language, but we wanted to talk about that potential dash to today. This new amendment seeks to address some of the questions and potential concerns that I've heard from the industry, but ultimately this amendment is pretty simple. It would prohibit service providers from refusing service or upcharging individuals who are unwilling to let their information be collected or sold. It would allow someone to change their mind if they agreed to let the service provider freely use their information and then decided they no longer wanted that to happen. Service providers would be required to disclose the notice of privacy and exceptions to that privacy in a clear, conspicuous, and straightforward notice at the point of sale or at contract. The proposed amendment very clearly spells out that an internet service provider shall not use, disclose, sell, or permit access to customer personal information without their permission. I understand in order to do business that some forms of data collection and usage that occur by these businesses are in fact necessary, and I hope this updated amendment addresses those issues. So those include that an internet service provider may seek a customer's approval if information collected does not fit within the definition of customer personal information and is not otherwise accepted from the law. Under this amendment, customer personal information is defined as name, financial or billing information, social security number, billing address, demographic data, or information about an individual's use of the service, including web history, browsing history, app usage, IP addresses, geolocation information, financial information, health information, information pertaining to children, the content of communications, and device identifiers. This amendment would allow for the collection of data for the purpose of providing service for which the information is derived or what is necessary to provide the service itself, to advertisers or to market to the customer or provide a bill, to comply with a court order or provide assistance during emergencies, and to disclose aggregated data when an individual customer information and characteristics have been removed. I believe we have an opportunity in front of us to make sure Oregon is at the forefront of protecting privacy of its citizen, and I hope you will all vote aye on this amendment when we actually have it in front of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Rayfield, Vice Chair McLean, and members of the committee. I am Pam Marsh. I am the representative from House District 5, other end of the state, Southern Jackson County. In preparation for today's hearing, I spent some time last evening reviewing my recent internet history. And what I realized was, I really don't want any of you to know what's in there. In fact, I don't really want anyone to know what's in there. And in that respect, I think I'm pretty similar to millions of other Oregonians. But for the sake of this discussion here today, I am willing to share with you some of the contents of my browser history from the past week. First, there were many stops at Olus. No real surprise there. I shopped at Macy's for a coat, I think. I bought kids' books at Powell's. I read articles on sites maintained by the Oregonian, the Mail Tribune, the Huffington Post, and the Hill. I watched an episode of Big Little Lies on HBO via my Amazon Prime. I looked up an event sponsored by the Ashland Chamber of Commerce. I searched for Oregon's irrigation systems on the web. I watched a second episode of Big Little Lies. I read about internet privacy on Wikipedia. I watched Jimmy Kimmel tear up on the CNN site. I looked at the retirement calculator on NerdWallet and found out that I am nowhere close. And I looked up the definition of to smite. That might have happened during a specific committee hearing. All in all, I have to say, it's pretty conventional stuff. But add it all up, and with just a little effort, you can put together a pretty decent profile of me, what I read, where I shop, and what I shop for, my political leanings, my demographic profile, and something probably about the work I do. That alone is disturbing. But when that data is compiled and shared or even sold, that's an unacceptable invasion of my privacy. So what can I as an individual do about this? Well, one thing I cannot do is walk away from the internet. Like pretty much everybody else on the planet, I am dependent on it for work, for business and personal purchases, to stay informed. I'm lucky, at least when I'm at home, because I am served by Ashland FiberNet, which is a municipal system that is committed to user privacy. But many Oregonians, particularly those in rural areas, don't have a choice of providers. Instead, they need to use and be grateful for whatever service is provided. In an ideal world, I think there is no question that regulation of broadband providers would be implemented on a national basis. But if, as it appears, the federal government is going to decline to act, then it is our job as state leaders to step in to protect our citizens. I believe House Bill 2813's opt-in approach will ensure that internet users have the opportunity to make mindful, conscious decisions about the use of their personal information. At the same time, the bill provides reasonable exceptions for emergency and other critical needs, as outlined. Along with millions of other Oregonians, I urge you to support HB 2813 and A. With its amendment. Thank you so much.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the record. I'm Brian Clem, and I represent District 21, which we're sitting in now, and am happy to be here with my colleagues to talk about this issue of internet privacy. I had a constituent write me and was very upset about some repeal of by Congress of some congressional rule or some rules that were going to go into effect, and Congress repealed them and said, you know, you need to do a bill. So I looked around to see if there were any relating clauses floating around still this late in session, and found this one like 3 days before the deadline. Went to visit your chair, and she said, "Yeah, I already know. I'm already doing a bill on the topic. You know, do you want to join forces?" And I said, "Well, did you know that Barker has a bill relating to privacy?" And so that's how we got here. So the issue, I think, is that we all have been thinking for a while about privacy in the internet, and you know, some of them are very valid debates, like how much eavesdropping are we willing to accept by law enforcement if it stops terrorism? Those are legitimate, actual questions that get talked about around kitchen tables. I think that for most of us, there is a bottom line privacy right that we believe we have that says that government should not infringe on our privacy, and that we certainly don't want our personal data sold without our consent, that we want to at least know what's happening, and we want to be able to consent to it if you're going to sell our data. And that could be something as easy as when you visit Facebook and they're providing you a free service, you sign off in your terms and conditions that they're going to sell your data. Okay, that's part of the trade-off. You use their site, they're selling your data. But what I don't think is in anyone's mind is when I pay $80 a month to Comcast or Xfinity, that they would be taking just the fact that I'm hooking into their network to spy on my data and then sell it off to people to give them information about how to advertise to me. I'm okay with if I visit websites and they place cookies on my computer, that's part of what I'm getting into as a user for using their websites. I'm not okay with something that I consider to be now much more like a necessity in life that I'm paying for, using my own information, my browsing history, my app usage as a way to make more money. There's other ways to make money, including the fees I'm paying them. So the repeal of the privacy rules got a lot of people upset. I am not 100% sure what will happen in DC. It's kind of a debate now that there's no FTC or FCC rules, which you'll hear more about. Who's going to pick up the gap, and what are they going to do, and are they going to handle this issue, and are the feds capable of taking care of this so the states don't have to? But what I want very clear from the state of Oregon is that our privacy is very important to us, that if the Dash 2s aren't the final issue, then let's take, you know, the time to get it right. But we need to send a message to Washington, D.C. that we don't want our ISPs paying attention to what we're doing as a money-making enterprise. They should make it through other means, not by selling our data. Or at least if you're going to do it, tell us, make us sign something saying, yes, we're going to use your data to go make more money. Because I just don't really want them. Yours are innocuous. Mine aren't much more exciting. Maybe it's a little Pokemon Go and, you know, a few random stops at something with my daughter for, you know, designing her Girl Scout project. But other than that, there's nothing to hide. It's just it's my business, and I'm paying you money. Stop collecting my data. That's what I have to say. I think that these Dash 2s are much narrower than the first round of amendments we talked about. I don't know if they're perfect. I want to get to a place where the principle I just outlined is what we're shooting for, which is don't use our data without our consent to make money. Unless we're visiting your website or using your app, that's fine, but not the baseline load of connecting to the internet. That should not be an opportunity to take data and go sell it.
Not going anywhere.
Thank
you. Thanks. So, Chair Rayfield, Vice Chair McLean, thank you for this opportunity. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tana Sanchez. I am the State Representative for House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. Colleagues, I believe protecting our privacy is an issue that goes beyond partisanship, and that this same feeling is shared by the vast majority of Oregonians. Today, with House Bill 2813, I have such a hard time with numbers, I don't know why that is. We have an opportunity to codify that sentiment and take a leading effort to ensure the internet privacy for Oregonians is protected. In the wake of the recent actions at the federal level, my office has received many calls and emails from constituents who are deeply concerned about the impact of these decisions. Each person who has contacted my office has asked that we take some steps to protect internet privacy here in Oregon. Not one has asked us to remain idle on the issue. There are many other states across the country who have pending legislation on this issue, and I would like to direct you to a document on OLIS that shows a list of states and the actions that they are considering. One of these states is Minnesota, whose Senate overwhelmingly and with bipartisan support passed a bill similar to the amendment that is being brought forward and being discussed today to protect the internet privacy in that state. Washington State has pending legislation on this topic and is receiving broad support. Some may argue that the regulatory framework should exist at the federal level, not at the state level, which does make sense. However, recent actions on the federal level strongly suggest we can't afford to sit around and wait for Washington, D.C. to come through on this issue for us. We have a real opportunity to do something right for the residents of our states, and I think we should act on that. And let me just say that, you know, hearing more of everyone else's testimony, and then as I read the amendments, one of the biggest concerns that I have that is in my other life, the work that I do, I work with victims of domestic violence and children who live in foster care, people who spend a lot of time on the internet, and I always worry about their safety and the things that they don't know and may not understand about that. And I think about the big long list that says, you know, it's you agree to this, 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 and this, and you can't play on this unless you agree. I think, you know, it is what it is, but I don't think that the multitude of young people that we have doing this, you know, doing the internet far outweighs any kind of work that I do or things that I do on the internet. I don't think we should jeopardize their privacy either, because they don't know. They don't know enough to stay safe on this thing. They may not even know enough to opt out if we get to that place. I think it's so very, very important that we do the best we can to protect them. Thank you.
You all have questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward. It is an important issue. I have a couple of questions for you. And I think for me, we talk about federal law, we talk about state law. Do we have or have you asked LC maybe to prepare something, or do we have anything? I honestly looked on OLIS earlier, but I haven't looked since we came into committee. Something that shows the comparisons in what federal law covers, what state law covers. Do we have a comparison of that shows the protections that are there now? Because I think me, like probably so many others, we think we're protected by federal laws. So I'm just trying to understand if there's something out there, something we might be able to look at that might give us an idea.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, we don't have that from LC. I think the panels that follow the industry panel, I think will do a very good job of talking about what's happening at the federal level. And the panel after that is the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a legal group that does this kind of work and is doing it nationally. So I think there'll be some folks who can address that, but we don't have a document as such.
I have a follow-up.
Please.
Thank you. The other thing that you'd mentioned was that we'll be able to sign off electronically to give our consent. How will that work to do and maybe I misunderstood and I haven't seen the dash twos. Do people have to do an electronic signature? Is it a check the box? And Representative Sanchez brought up a good point. Will people even understand what they're signing off on, and how do you see that working?
Again, Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, I think as Representative Clem says, we're still working through all of this. I think that the intent is that there's some sort of knowledge and consent. So in the dash ones, it was a written consent. Now the dash twos don't have that. So I think that remains to be seen the appropriate way to, from a customer to a provider, how they would gain that consent. But the intention is to have a knowledgeable consent. So the form, I think, is, you know, at least I know that I'm willing to figure out what works, but primary purpose is to have some sort of informed consent.
Stakeholders have been at the table, I assume, with some of the talking about what this would look like, what would work, what.
We haven't gotten that far yet.
Okay. One last question.
Please.
I'm just curious if you know what the AG's thoughts are, where their position is.
conversation with.
Okay, great. I mean, I'm just throwing, just have some questions, but I get where you're going.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, part of the urgency or the time timeline here is that Congress just repealed these rules March 28th. Maybe it was April 28th. Let me double check. March 28th. So it's a relatively recent action. And in particular, the concern is that the, and I don't want to confuse you, but I'm sorry, I don't have these in writing. One agency is the FCC. They can do regulations. Another agency is the FTC. They could do regulations. The FTC regulations don't consider browsing history or app usage sensitive or protected. The FCC did. Those got repealed. So now you're left with the FTC, which doesn't protect it, which is why then either you would want the FTC to mirror what was going to be the FCC rules, or somebody
that's
in government would do
at.
It.
All right. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Just very briefly, I just wanted to thank you guys for doing this. As many folks know, I worked for Senator Wyden for a number of years, and he has long been a champion and advocate of Internet privacy, starting with his work on net neutrality before anybody had ever heard that expression. And this is another really important element, and I think this is one of those opportunities for us to say, hey, if this is going away at the federal level, we need to do what we can at the state level to make sure that we continue that really important privacy right. So thank you all.
Thank you. And just in the spirit of equality, if Representative Sanchez and Representative Williams could submit their browsing history to the committee by tomorrow, we would appreciate that. Thank you.
Vice Chair, for the record, I do watch Big Little Lies, too, so I was actually happy to hear that she brought that. It's a good show.
All right. Brant Wolf, Joni Deutsch, and Kate Lucente. And I just want to say publicly thank the industry who's met with me. We've talked through some of this. It's one of the reasons that we're only having a public hearing today to start kind of vetting this issue. And I don't have all of Representative Hack's answers yet, but I want to publicly thank folks for meeting with me and walking through some of this. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Williamson, members of the committee. Joni Deutsch, Executive Director for the Northwest for TechNet. TechNet represents over 70 of the nation's leading companies in the fields of high-tech manufacturing, computer networking, information technology, clean energy, life sciences, internet media, e-commerce, and the sharing economy sectors. Our members include breakthrough startups and the most storied, life-changing technology companies on the planet. We as an industry keep America's innovation economy growing and creating more good-paying jobs. With the recent actions at the federal level, we understand that you may have concerns regarding consumers' internet privacy. First and foremost, our member companies take their consumers' privacy concerns very seriously, and TechNet believes consumers' reasonable expectations of privacy should be met when they engage in online and offline activity alike. As this policy was being debated at the federal level, TechNet submitted comments endorsing the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, stated goals of transparency, choice, and security for consumers, and acknowledging that both the FTC and the FCC recognize the importance of consumer notice of privacy practices and the collection of sensitive data for marketing and third-party sharing. We want to assure you that nothing for consumers has changed. The repeal of the FCC's broadband privacy rules leaves in place the legal framework that has existed since the FCC adopted the Open Internet Order over 2 years ago and reclassified Internet Access Service as a telecommunications service. The FCC's reclassification of broadband as a common carrier offering removed the FTC's established privacy jurisdiction over ISPs. In order to ensure that consumers' data and privacy would be protected, the FCC issued an enforcement advisory outlining that the Communications Act, specifically Section 222, continues to apply to ISPs who should, quote, employ effective privacy protections in line with their privacy policies and core tenets of basic privacy protections. This guidance, which continues to apply today, ensures continued oversight of ISP privacy practices under the Communications Act, even in the absence of specific rules. ISPs also continue to be subject to a wide range of federal and state privacy and data security laws that protect consumers' data. This includes the Children's Online Privacy Act, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, the CAN-SPAM Act, data breach notification laws in virtually every state in the country, privacy statutes, common law legal doctrines protecting privacy and data security. The FTC's privacy framework advanced the principles of privacy by design, choice, and transparency, and has supported the FTC enforcement actions that have held online companies responsible for their actions. The FTC's guidelines offer a balanced approach that gives consumers the protections they need and offers businesses the opportunities to compete and innovate in the growing online marketplace. Given the ever-evolving nature of the Internet, as well as the jurisdictional issues at play with the federal government, online privacy is a complex issue. The FTC has a proven framework that protects consumers and allows innovative new services to proliferate. To that end, proposing new state requirements will only confuse consumers who should have the ability to rely on clear, uniform privacy protections across the Internet. Consumers benefit by keeping a single uniform set of privacy obligations governing broadband data, which is based on the FTC's time-tested framework. Thank you.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify about the ISP privacy amendments proposed to HB 2813. My name is Kate Lucente. I'm a privacy lawyer who has counseled ISPs and many companies on privacy compliance issues related to the Internet ecosystem for many years. I'm here today on behalf of the State Privacy and Security Coalition, which is composed of 27 major technology, media, communications, and retail companies, as well as six trade associations in these sectors. HB 2813 would not meaningfully increase consumer online privacy protection, but it would stifle innovation and lead to disparate and confusing sets of rules and selectively burden ISPs. Arguments that the congressional action in March preventing the FCC broadband privacy rules from taking effect has freed ISPs to sell customer information is simply false. The elimination of the FCC's privacy rules, as Joni mentioned, which were applicable to ISPs, has not changed anything. The rules had not gone into effect. ISP customers are already protected from having data such as their personal web browsing history sold without their consent. All major ISPs have committed, as set forth in their privacy policies, to practices consistent with the FTC's privacy framework, which provide clear guidance about what choices consumers should receive. ISPs also committed in January, as reflected in their privacy policies, and also they committed in January to the ISP privacy principles, which follow the FTC privacy and security guidelines and commit them to not sharing customer browsing history without consent. So assumptions that eliminating the FCC broadband privacy rules has left a regulatory vacuum for ISP information practices are simply inaccurate. In addition to ISP commitments in their respective privacy policies and under the ISP privacy principles, the privacy protections under the Communications Act continue to apply to the privacy practices of ISPs. The FCC has actively enforced in the privacy and data security areas, bringing actions and imposing fines. And since 2015, when the FCC issued enforcement guidance under Section 222 of the Communications Act, it has made clear its intention to continue to enforce that statute. So, Section 222 continues to apply today and ensures that ISPs can be held accountable for privacy violations. The FCC and acting FTC chairwoman issued a joint statement in the Washington Post that they have the tools currently to protect ISP consumer privacy. For example, the Communications Act, the Cable Act, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and when ISPs are acting as web publishers, the FTC privacy framework. Moreover, there are established state privacy, data protection, and consumer protection laws. For example, I mentioned ISPs have committed not to sell consumer browsing history without consent from their customers. That's an enforceable promise, enforceable under state unfair and deceptive business practices laws in addition to other laws. More importantly, just this past week, FCC Chairman Pai announced an intention to restore oversight of ISP consumer privacy to the FTC by changing the classification of broadband service. The regulatory proposal would restore to the FTC oversight of the privacy and security of ISP consumer data. The FTC, just like the FCC, is a very strong enforcer of consumer privacy interests, enforcing privacy and security for the rest of the internet just as they enforced ISP privacy and security before the FCC's net neutrality order took that jurisdiction from the FTC and put it with the FCC. Any action taken by an individual state on the privacy issues in the context of ISPs is premature and could lead to consumer confusion, as well as disparate legal regimes and uncertainty, and would further not meaningfully benefit consumers who are already protected from having data such as their personal web browsing history sold by ISPs without consent. No other state has passed a bill to regulate an interstate service following the repeal of the ISP privacy rules. Oregon should not be the first. Creating new and different standards in Oregon could disrupt a significant portion of the state's innovation economy and have major unintended consequences for consumers and for businesses, as companies are forced to adjust their investment and technology deployment plans based on a singular set of rules in one state. It could also ultimately lead to less competition, as this bill will serve as a disincentive to new ISP providers in Oregon. Given these issues, this bill is unnecessary. Key points that I would ask you to consider while deliberating this bill. No ISP consumer has had more privacy protections 2 months ago, 2 years ago than they have today. The FCC's privacy rules had not gone into effect. All that happened was that the CRA restored the status quo that had existed for 2 years since the FCC's net neutrality order. The FCC, the nation's expert communications regulator, retains authority over ISPs to police egregious privacy practices, which it has actively been doing. Further, the FCC has clearly stated that it intends to hand back enforcement authority to the FTC, the nation's top consumer privacy enforcer. And both the FCC and the FTC heads have consistently stated publicly that they intend to work together now to develop an approach that does not leave any gaps or uncertainty in this space. This bill would create significant barriers to innovation that have nothing to do with the sale or use or access to customer data. This is a very complex issue, and Oregon should not hastily enact a law with serious unintended consequences. The FTC, under the former administration, engaged in a thoughtful, multi-year process that solicited and took into account input from multiple stakeholders from all sides of the fence and aisle before publishing its framework for consumer privacy protection. The FTC was very careful to impose technology and industry neutral rules and a framework that provided meaningful consumer privacy protections without unnecessarily stifling innovation and commerce. We urge the chairwoman and the members of the committee to consider the consequences that hastily enacted legislation can have on both consumers and businesses, and to note that the latest draft of the Oregon ISP privacy bill is in fact substantially similar to legislation that was rejected in Washington. Further, other ISP opt-in privacy bills have been rejected in, for example, Maryland, Montana, Hawaii, North Dakota, and Vermont this session. As of now, opt-in ISP privacy bills appear unlikely to pass in most of the other states where they are listed as pending. Also, because the bill would restrict certain activities, such as analytics and advertising, in a very selective way, it raises very serious First Amendment questions, as noted by the renowned First Amendment scholar and Professor Lawrence Tribe in comments he filed with the FCC in response to the FCC's ISP privacy rules. Thank you very much. I'd be very happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I'm with the Oregon Telecommunications Association. You've seen a coalition letter that has many logos on it. Many of those are from our small company members, small telecommunications service providers, and small ISPs that operate in rural parts of the state. Oftentimes, they are the only ISP or telecommunications service provider in their area. I understand we've moved on from the Dash Ones, but I feel obligated to tell you, because I've been thinking about it for 3 days now, that we had some major problems with those Dash Ones. And in fact, many of my members told me that they could not comply with them, and they might not even be able to continue offering the service that they had to offer. Moving on from that, I mean, you've heard a lot of information here today. I think a couple of things I just want to emphasize. Our members do not sell this information now. We have absolutely no plans to do so. I can't stress that enough. We don't collect this, we don't sell it, and we're not going to. I think you should also know that for many years now, I mean, this is a new issue, I understand, to a lot of people, but for our members and our customers, we have been safeguarding their private information for many, many years now. It's something we take very seriously, and we're very good at it. We do this under the auspices of the Federal Communications Commission or the Federal Trade Commission under the programs that they have developed over many years. It's a time-consuming task, necessarily. There are many, many interested parties, most of whom are not in this room right now, that would need to avail themselves of the opportunity to let you know how they feel about this. There are, I mean, we have our members here. You know who they are, I think, most of them. But there are literally hundreds of certificated telecommunications providers in the state of Oregon alone that I would think that their opinion needed to be taken into account. The point of all that is we urge this committee not to support the amendments to 2813. We urge this committee rather to defer to the Federal Trade Commission, let them do their work. They're very good at it. It takes time. I understand that. But they can do the job, and they can do the job well. We have demonstrated that we will live with those programs and administer them to the best of our ability and safeguard, continue to safeguard, our customers' information. I agree. I'm a consumer of these services myself. I agree that there needs to be some privacy safeguards in place. But there's an appropriate place to do that, and we don't believe the state of Oregon is the appropriate place to do that. We have large members such as CenturyLink and Frontier who operate in many, many states, and for them to have to operate under different sets of rules in different states is inappropriate. There are small companies that have the same exact situation, small ISPs that operate close to our border with Washington. They have customers on both sides of the river, and I think it's a legitimate question that would need to be asked and answered how this would apply to them and what it might mean to them. I don't want to belabor this. You've heard a lot. I'm sure you have questions. There are others that want to talk about this, so I'll stop there. But I'll just emphasize, we don't sell this information. We safeguard our consumers' privacy, and we'll continue to do so. Let the Federal Trade Commission do their job. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Kate, you were quite emphatic that they're already protected and that their information cannot be sold. So since the repeal, are ISPs able to sell customers' web browsing history? And can you maybe expound on that a bit?
Sure, happy to. So I can't speak for every single ISP, in the country, but what I can say is that all major ISPs have committed publicly in their privacy policies not to sell customer browsing history without consent. I'm not aware of any other ISP that sells customer browsing data without their consent. Those are public promises that are enforceable under state law, most under state consumer protection laws. Those are public promises that are enforceable by the FCC, the Federal Communications Regulator. And when the FCC turns jurisdiction back over to the FTC, those will be promises that are enforceable by the FTC. So, yes, consumers are protected currently from having their browsing history sold without their consent.
A follow-up. So do ISPs, when you sign up, do they have a contract basically that says we won't sell, your personal information and that people just agree to that, or that they have that as a policy that they promote?
Right. So, I mean, it's hard to speak for all ISPs, but typically the way this is handled is through disclosures and a privacy notice that state what information is collected, how it's used, and how it may be disclosed. And then in the sign-up process for signing up for service or later signing up for particular services, there would be some form of a consent in there to having your data sold or disclosed to third parties. So you would give your consent. And I can't speak for the exact mechanism every time, but that's typically how it works.
So I'm going to go ahead, if I can, and move to the person who's been on the phone for over an hour waiting, and then we can take more questions after we hear from him. He's just been really, I'm assuming, patient, and that he's still on the phone. Hi, Ernesto, are you on the phone? Are you on mute?
I'm here, yes.
Oh, okay. Do you want to introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, my name is Ernesto Falcone. I'm the legislative counsel for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you. The chair and members of the committee, thank you for having me here to testify. I have worked in communications policy as both a congressional staffer and consumer advocate for more than 10 years, and appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. First, I want to make it very, very clear. When Congress passes a law, it means something. And many of the opponents of the state of Oregon passing its own broadband privacy law in response to the Congressional Review Act repeal are incorrect in asserting that nothing has changed. What Congress did was repeal and prohibit the Federal Communications Commission from enforcing Section 222 of the Communications Act in very specific ways, namely the requirement that ISPs must obtain the consent of their customers before using their personal data for resale to third parties. Should an ISP engage in the very activities Congress banned the FCC from addressing, an ISP is going to have very powerful defenses in court to argue that Congress has spoken and that the agency is not allowed to enforce the privacy law in that manner. That's essentially the entire point of a Congressional Review Act repeal. Second, opponents of the state of Oregon filling the void Congress created are arguing that ISPs are not uniquely situated to gather personal information of their customers. This is also incorrect. When you go on the internet, the ISP must know where you go online. It needs to know what websites you interact with in order to provide you the service. The only means to shield your activity from your ISP is essentially to pay an additional money to utilize a remote encrypted server over what's called a virtual private network. That basically means the only way you can hide your activity from your ISP is to pay more money and to connect to a different ISP. In essence, it's a tax for your privacy. And this is the heart of Peter Swire's often cited report by the ISP industry about how that consumers are able to hide themselves from ISP, the prying eyes of the ISP. Lastly, I believe it's absolutely essential that this committee understand the legal landscape for ISP oversight and how it's shifting at the federal level, particularly in terms of the ramifications it has for Oregonians. The current FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, has embarked on a plan to surrender the FCC's oversight authority over cable and telephone companies by reclassifying them as information services. After two significant federal court decisions litigated by Comcast and Verizon against the FCC, virtually no substantive or comprehensive authority over information services exists at the FCC. Media reports indicate that the FCC chairman hopes that the Federal Trade Commission will fill in this new void that he will create in consumer protection. However, for states like Oregon, this is completely unworkable as a matter of law. In 2016, the Ninth Circuit held that the Federal Trade Commission has no legal jurisdiction over common carriers. This holding will still apply to telephone companies, even if the FCC ends the common carrier status of broadband companies. The FCC acknowledges this glaring hole in their plan by tucking away the problem in footnote 153 in the proposal. They recognize that telephone companies with broadband businesses will be exempt from federal enforcement from both the FCC and the FTC, and that they just hope that the FCC will win their en banc appeal at the Ninth Circuit. In conclusion, I want to applaud the legislature for exploring this issue and responding to the public demand for action. A recent YouGov poll found that 80% of Democratic voters, 75% of Republican voters, and 69% of independents believe that President Trump should have vetoed the broadband privacy repeal. That's because people value their privacy, and they do not believe their ISP should be able to use their personal information without their affirmative consent, and are strongly in favor of a law that makes it so. Thank you. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I'm going to have Kimberly go ahead before we take questions.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I'd just like to provide sort of a rights-based framework for this and maybe clear up a few things as well. When the FCC privacy rules were repealed, there was a lot of activity, as I'm sure you can imagine, on our national listservs with different affiliates saying what's happening with this. And there are many, many states right now who are looking to do the same thing. In in most of those states, they're very broad bipartisan groups of folks that are looking at this issue because privacy is important to all of us. I know that in particular that the language that we're looking at here that is on OLIS, that right now Alaska has a bill that has this almost exact same language. New Hampshire has a bill. And Washington, someone mentioned earlier something about the Washington bill not being alive, but that's I spoke to someone today from Washington. They are actively working on a bill with substantially similar language to this bill right here. So, and that was from the ACLU of Washington. So, I mean, what I'm seeing, at least from the sort of ACLU perspective, is that there's a lot of chatter and a lot of movement towards towards trying to get this particular language that we're looking at here adopted across the country. You know, using the internet, as folks have talked about already, is really like it's an essential part of our lives at this point. But I think it's also beyond that. It's also become an essential part of the way that we exercise our rights. So our freedom of speech, our expression, our association, and our religion often are very, very intertwined with the internet. And it's incredibly important that we preserve an equal sort of playing field in this realm and that people don't have to sort of choose between their privacy and being able to engage in these activities that are really their constitutionally protected activities and privacy and either doing those things. As was mentioned earlier, especially for folks in rural areas, most people don't have a choice of their ISP provider. You know, if I don't like Facebook, which no offense to anybody, I'm not a fan. I deactivated my account a year and a half ago. I'm not a super big fan of using Google, so I use DuckDuckGo. You know, we have choices about which services we use. We can make decisions based on, you know, which entities have promised to protect our privacy, which ones haven't, what their policies are, and so on. But we just don't have that same kind of choice when it comes to our ISP. Let's see here. I also want to emphasize that this isn't just about private entities and private entities having and selling our information. It also has to do with the government as well, because we know that often the government actually turns to private entities to buy information. So this really could have to do with the government and their access to our information as well. One thing that hasn't come up yet, but that is in the language of the bill that I think is really important, is emphasizing that there shouldn't be like a fee that you have to pay or some sort of charge for being able to have these privacy rights, what some folks refer to as pay-to-play. No discount, like you get a discount for sharing your privacy or being able to have your service refused if you don't consent. So those are just a couple of things that I think are important. I've uploaded testimony and also uploaded with my testimony. I actually submitted something that was submitted in Washington when there was a hearing up there. It's from her name is Laura Moy. She's from the Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology. There's some stuff in here that she writes about that I think is germane to some of the conversation we've had about whether or not existing law is sufficient. She talks about, as the gentleman from EFF talked about the FTC's inability to oversee common carrier ISPs, and also talks about the fact that there are some things that are really left vague as well and ambiguous in current law, particularly as it relates to what is consent and so on. So I just encourage you to look there. And finally, just to wrap up, I'd just like to comment on what I'm hearing in opposition to this bill is everybody's already protected. We're not using and selling this information. But if you do this, it's going to somehow harm us. So that seems very contradictory to me. And particularly when I'm looking at the language of this bill, the idea that it's confusing, I don't think it's confusing. It's what is your personal information and using your personal information. To the degree that there are some specific uses that are justified, that aren't included in this, I think then, you know, we'd be happy to have a conversation about it and participate in that. And I'm connected to national experts on it, so offer my services.
Thank you. I am cognizant of the time. We have two more folks signed up. I'm going to bring them up. This is not the end of this conversation. There is clearly a lot of information, both that we've been given and up in OLIS. So Mike and Trey, if you want to come down and close out the hearing, I'm sure we will be back to discuss all of these things. I'll read all the answers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association, representing ISP providers. And not only do we have the FTC rules that you've heard already, and I'm not going to go into that, we also have rules on the telephone side on privacy and the video side. This is complicated. I don't understand all of the jurisdictional battles at the FTC and FCC, but one thing that really hasn't been discussed, and this is probably why I think you need to slow down, is we're talking about privacy as it represents the ISPs. These are the providers that provide the pipe. And what the FCC and the FTC want to do, according to the acting director at the FTC and the chair of the FCC, is they want to fix the gap. And that can only really be done at the federal level. And that gap is, how do you want the rules to go forward with ISPs and coincide with the leading edge providers, which also collect data? So by virtue of passing this bill, you haven't really solved all of the issues about privacy. And so we don't really need a patchwork. So wouldn't it be nice if we could do this nationally? And I think, from what I gather, there is a lot of desire to do that. The last thing I would say is I get very concerned about this because of how the internet works. It is a global network, and how the internet protocol addresses work. And I'm concerned by virtue of passing an Oregon law and where that Oregon ISP or IP address is, we're going to have companies tweak their software to ensure that they're not collecting data that they are collecting somewhere else in another state. And because I haven't had a chance really to look at this, I don't know if that is something that might occur where we then have to tweak our software. Brant Wolf talked about the smaller companies being able to adhere to the rules, whatever rules there are. A lot of the smaller companies are resellers. So they're reselling the service, and that's over somebody's network. And I get concerned then, do they get in a web here by virtue of doing that? And so that's kind of an unintended consequences. And we have a lot of small ISP providers, and this could be something that could be expensive to them. So I'll stop there, Madam Chair.
And thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak. And I can't add a whole lot to what's already been said.
Can you say your name for the
record? Yes, I'm sorry. Trey Hendricks with CenturyLink. And being a first-year lobbyist, I'll take some liberty in making some mistakes and hopefully not saying too many stupid things. But what I do want to say is that it's important to note that there are rules in place now, that there is not a vacuum that needs to be filled by the state or really by anyone else at this point. But it's critical for businesses large and small, and you have a letter with a list of many carriers, edge providers, content providers, network providers, and all of these companies participated in the FCC process, hundreds of stakeholders, to develop the rules, which were never implemented. They were never enacted by the FCC. And so where we are now that the FCC was prevented from implementing those rules is we're in the same place we were before. And I think I just closed by saying, and I think it was Representative Clem who made the point, that we need to take the time to get this right. The FCC, again, took close to 2 years to figure this out with thousands of pages of comments from folks who really understood these issues. So I think to try and get this done in 5 or 6 weeks or how much time we have left is, if not impossible, very difficult, and we risk causing some serious problems, not just for the companies, but for the folks who use the internet in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm going to close the hearing
thank you very much.
On this bill. Thank you very much. Close the hearing on House Bill 2813. And colleagues, I'm going to bring up one witness who came from more than 100 miles away and it wasn't marked on the sheet. So I'm going to reopen a hearing on House Bill 2221. I know some of you need to leave, so if you do, please. And Shar Rivas.
Where else would I write?
Hi.
Want to search my browser?
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for hearing me. I appreciate it. So I'm here today to ask you to vote no on HB 2122A. CCOs are working well in their communities. If the CCO model works, then why do we ever need to make the change? The changes HB 2122A call for. By the name, my name is Shar Revison. I am the chair to the Rural Advisory Council for Trillium OHP, which is part of the Community Advisory Council, but the rural part of it. Anyway, I just said my last sentence there. Since Lane County includes a large rural area, Trillium formed a second Community Advisory Council to address the needs of rural communities. And the RAC meets monthly and has identified issues that Trillium has been responsive to address, such as access and health equity. The RAC has been a strong advocate for prevention programs in rural communities, such as the Good Behavior Game, an evidence-based classroom management tool that prevents tobacco use, and an obesity prevention program called the VERB Summer Scorecard, which encourages exercise through a variety of outdoor activities. In 2015, Trillium brought a mobile vision van to Florence and Reedsport to provide vision exams and glasses to adults who weren't eligible for this benefit on OHP. Many people in my community receive glasses and are able to perform better at their jobs or read to their children or grandchildren thanks to Trillium. I also appreciate Trillium's support to expand behavioral health services in the rural communities of Florence. This is a crucial step in providing services to a population that has been underserved for years. Trillium's partnership is an asset as we move forward with these efforts. I believe that changing anything at this stage would be detrimental to consumers, healthcare providers, and the Oregon Health Plan itself. The program is working extremely well for all as it stands right now. So if it's not broken, don't fix it. It's working. So please, I'm asking for your opposition to House Bill 2122A. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2122A, sorry, and I'm going to open a quick work session on House Bill 2584.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2584 was heard on the 25th of April. It identifies specific types of expenditures that are defined as in coordination for the purposes of independent expenditure, lowers the threshold for reporting, increases the penalties for violations of reporting. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we adopted on the 25th the dash 2 amendments. We have a dash 4 amendments that do replace the dash 2. The dash 4s increases the penalties from 10% to 20% for failure to file for expenditures under $1,000. It increases it to 40% for expenditures over $1,000. It also does incorporate what the dash 2s did, which was remove the auditing requirements. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have permission once again to rescind the referral to Ways and Means on the dash 4 amendment. The first though order of action today is we need to reconsider and rescind from the dash 2 amendments that were adopted on the 25th and then adopt the new amendments and move forward.
And Madam Chair, may I kind of address kind of the process?
Discussion.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move to rescind the vote by which the committee adopted the dash 2 amendments on April 25th, 2017.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved to rescind the vote by which the committee adopted the dash 2 amendments on April 25th, 2017. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Rayfield.
Thank you, Madam Chair. During our last conversation, Representative McLean and I were going back and forth with respect to, I think it's probably an accurate depiction, on the increasing the fines on PAC violations. Since that time, both Representative McLean and I, we actually met with one of the PAC treasurers that I met with, and the PAC treasurer explained to him some of the problems that the increased fines were meant to address. Through that conversation, Representative McLean and I worked on a floated some ideas and a different way to address the issue, which is in the Dash 4 amendment, which actually increases the fines from 10 to 20% on anything less than $1,000 of a contribution or expenditure, and increases it for the larger contributions to 40% for things $1,000 and greater. Based upon that, Representative McLean was going to speak that he was okay with it at this point. At least that's what he told me on the floor. He's not here to do so, so I'm just conveying that information, and we'll go from there.
Any further discussion? Representative Bretta.
Was it a peaceful working situation?
Any more discussion? All right.
It's quite peaceful.
Are there any objections? If not, motion passes. And so, once again, House Bill 2584 is in before this committee in its original form.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2584.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2584. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, are there any objections? Do you need? Okay.
No.
Motion passes. All right. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2584 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 2584 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. Carrier, Representative Rayfield. And with that, we are going to roll over House Bill 2342, sorry, to Tuesday. All right, thank you all for hanging out.
Hot timing.
All right, thank you all for hanging out.
Hot timing.